Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So I'm Josephine Ensign, and I am here today with Representative Nicole Macri. And it is It is July 29th, 2022, and we're at Jack Straw Studios. So is it okay if I call you Nicole?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Nicole, as you and I were talking about this, this is an oral history interview for kind of what I call my Skid Road / Way Home project. And it's really about people who work at the intersection of health, homelessness, all sorts of different systems with that in Seattle and King County. So the first question I have for you is, what led you to the work that you do?
That's a good question, and one I think about often. What motivated me to begin to get into this work, and what kind of keeps me in this work? So I think the answer is, in my childhood, I had a few experiences that really led me to just appreciate the importance of having a home and how tenuous it is. And that is really through other people's experiences, mm-hmm. not my own. One experience I had when I was in the fifth grade, a classmate of mine who I was not particularly close with, his house burned down when his family was home. And they all got out of the home with the help of the fire department, but they were displaced. Their home was destroyed. And they were staying temporarily in a hotel. And my mother reached out to, not to the family directly, but to folks in her friend circle who were closer with the family, asking, who's helping? Can we contribute in some way? What can we do? And I recall her on the phone for a couple days and her frustration that nobody was doing anything. And so she called the mother of my classmate and invited the family to come live in our basement until they had a place to live. So they stayed with us for several weeks, this family of five, two parents and three boys and a dog. You know, ate meals with us and were really sort of integrated with our family life for a while. And I just really took the lesson that when people need help, particularly when they don't have a home, you just help them.
Mm-hmm.
In my family, I've had many members of my family who have lived with and struggled with mental illness and substance use. And in that same basement, we had my dad's brother stay with us for a while. He was a pretty consistent heroin user and on off the streets for many years. And I just remember he was mostly sleeping. The lights were off. The shades were drawn during the day. And again, my mom said, he's family. He needs a place to live. That's just what we do. And I think that in, you know, years later, when I reflect on that, those sorts of experiences really influence my perception of homelessness, the trauma and impact it has on families, and not just immediate families, but extended families as well. And just really felt drawn in particular to work to address homelessness and directly assist people experiencing homelessness.
Nice. Pretty remarkable mother. So, and where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay. Nice. So opened up that basement. Okay. And then what has either kind of what or who, obviously you just kind of answered that with, at least with your mother, has most influenced the work that you do?
Yeah, I've had a couple of mentors in my career, in my adult life, that really have influenced me as well. So pretty early in my career, I had a strong desire to try to work to assist people who are homeless. And when I graduated from college, I first worked in mental health, in a mental health center for a little while. And then I got a position working in a community kitchen, a soup kitchen in downtown Atlanta, Georgia. And I pretty soon into that met a retired gentleman who was basically a full-time volunteer who worked at different soup kitchens, essentially doing street outreach and assisting people with information, driving people around town for healthcare appointments or housing appointments or appointments at the Social Security office downtown. And he really taught me that you can just do what it takes to help people and really open my eyes to the bureaucratic hurdles that people encounter in their quest for more stability, and showed me there's ways to challenge those systems, navigate through them. His name is Alan Harris, and he actually was a he worked at the Social Security Administration for the federal government.
Oh, so he knew,
and he knew he had he had a lot of insight and frustration with the federal bureaucracies and his retirement. Just, you know, remained very mission focused in helping people who have been marginalized. And then I I moved to Seattle in 1999, and I worked actually doing domestic violence response work. But the way my work schedule worked out, I was able to volunteer during the week and really missed that work at the soup kitchen, and looked around and got connected to DESC downtown and started volunteering there in their shelter, what they call the main shelter on 3rd Ave.
That's now closed.
Yes. Yep. And I started working as what they called a coffee counter volunteer, just serving coffee to folks, handing out hygiene supplies for people to take showers, and helping pass out mail to DESC shelter clients. Job came open at DESC, and I applied for it. It was their fundraising manager position. And through that, I got to work with Bill Hobson for for about 14 years. He and I worked very closely together. He was my supervisor the whole time I was at DESC until he retired. And I just learned so much similarly about just speaking truth to power and doing whatever it takes to assist people and challenging systems that tell us that we cannot help people or people aren't ready for help. So those Alan and Bill were two big influences in my life.
And so who or what led you to think about public service and running for the state legislature as representative?
Yeah, so I had not at all thought of myself as an elected official or that I would be a politician or seek that out. But when my state representative opted not to run for reelection and the seat was opened up in the 43rd Legislative District, I had some friends who work in housing and homelessness advocacy approach me. First one, then a few more saying, you really should run for that seat in the state legislature. And I immediately thought, I don't know anything about politics. I don't know anyone in politics. I've never thought about this. I don't think I'm qualified to do it. And then I had some people say, well, before you say no, why don't you talk to this one more person? And that person would say, why don't you talk to this one person? And then I kind of got directed to a few elected officials who I knew who served in Seattle City Council at that time, State Senator Pramila Jayapal, and just to ask what it was like, and then ultimately decided in a pretty short period of time to just throw my hat in the ring and see how it go. It's a very competitive district. It's a strongly Democratic district. But as the more I delved into campaigning, the more passionate I became about serving in public service. And I just had so many wonderful conversations with neighbors and residents in the area about the challenges that folks were having, particularly around housing, concerns that neighbors had about homelessness and what the state was doing to address it.
And so remind me, which year was this?
That was in 2016.
Okay, so yeah. Right after the declaration Seattle and King County.
It's when we thought homelessness was
curable.
Really bad, but we could be on a path to solve it. It was a top issue of concern. It was just becoming a top issue of concern. You know, for many years, transportation, education, access to jobs, those issues were top issues. And housing, as housing costs, you know, that post-recessionary increase in housing costs and concurrent increase in homelessness really shifted people's concern and focus on that. And it seemed I was the right person with the right background for that time. Little did we know the issue would worsen. I mean, there were obviously indicators that things would not get better if we didn't take more significant, bold action. But I've been in legislature since 2017 for the last 6 years and have worked primarily on housing and homelessness and behavioral health and healthcare access issues.
Right. And working this last legislative session with some pretty amazing legislation, including Apple Health and Homes with Representative Chop. So can you say a little bit more about that, of like where those initial ideas came from?
Yeah. So Frank, for a long time, had been talking about this idea of a prescription for a home, and he and I talked about it, and I, of course, was all about it and actually introduced him to some folks I knew from other parts of the country who had been working on similar efforts. And he started, pulling together people to draft legislation. And at first, honestly, it felt so convoluted to, take this big idea and really operationalize it, that I wasn't sure that it was going to be a successful endeavor. And I remember the initial hearing on the bill, on the initial draft of the bill, there's all sorts of feedback about, you know, well-intended, but we're not sure that this can actually work. And I really committed myself in partnership with Representative Chop to, like, let's fix what mm-hmm. needs to be fixed so this bill can be workable. And we fine-tuned it over the course of the session and really, I think, made it a national model in terms of policy. We were fortunate to be able to work with some experts, including Debbie Thiel from the Corporation for Supportive Housing, mm-hmm. Who had a lot of experience in how Medicaid-funded services and HUD or locally funded housing could be integrated to the benefit of people living with serious disability. So that helped us tremendously. So it was really a great experience. We were both really surprised, I think, about the amount of bipartisan mm-hmm. support for the bill. I felt like we really turned a corner. I really credit Representative Chop for just his style and his outreach to folks. He really is a compelling and persuasive person. Mm-hmm. He was able to get, I think, colleagues of ours who are more conservative, who historically have had pretty stigmatizing views of people experiencing homelessness, and really shift the narrative by talking about people living with disabilities, particularly people living with mental illnesses, and relating that to people's own personal family experiences. And mm-hmm. I think that really resonated. The bill passed almost unanimously, one no vote in the House. So that really floored me.
It's
it was awesome.
Almost unheard of
yeah.
for something around homelessness.
Yeah.
Indeed. I was on some of the planning things and testified with the first round and was not surprised, but found it fascinating, the pushback from probably more conservative people in the House, but that were on that healthcare and wellness committee, but also in terms of rural areas of Washington State. And it seemed as if, from my perspective, of both of you working it in terms of it being not just, you know, Seattle, King County, that it was really, and that it wasn't just a pilot study, mm-hmm. that it's really going to be rolled out across the state.
Yeah,
as well.
I think you're right. I think that made a really big difference. And really listening to our colleagues in rural areas and incorporating their feedback into the bill,
mm-hmm.
I think that made a big difference. There was a moment, the kind of a behind-the-scenes moment where some of our Republican colleagues were working on a striking amendment, and we were working on fine-tuning some things in the bill. And we got together and said, well, can we just work together on the same amendment rather than having competing ones?
Yeah.
And that is a rare – it happens sometimes, but it's a rare occurrence, and it was really great.
And how much in your conversations and kind of behind the scenes work with that, how much do you think the experience for everybody in terms of the COVID 19 pandemic, in terms of health, you know, health and homes for pretty much everybody, and then also, you know, obviously the massive increase, unfortunately, in like suicides and mental illness. How much do you think that played into, especially the bipartisan support?
Yeah, I think that probably played a lot into it. I think the increases in opioid dependence in rural areas of the state and the behavioral health, the exacerbation of behavioral health challenges that we've seen through the pandemic really influence people's thinking. And that homelessness is now visible in areas that where we haven't seen it before, including in rural areas. And I think legislators felt like, well, if I can get a solution that works in my area and isn't just an urban specific one, maybe that helps my neighbors and constituents.
Oh, good. So, and I know you've been working in, because besides, you know, being a representative, you're also the deputy director now of DESC, and now I've worked in various, including the coffee the coffee cart one at DESC. So, no, and as you were kind of touching on, you're even involved in this nationally in terms of Housing First. So what have you seen, especially during the whole time with the pandemic and racial reckoning, what have you seen, heard, kind of both positive and negative in terms of Housing First and support for it and understanding of it?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I feel like we have come full circle. I started working at DESC in 2002, so 20 years ago. And we were really pushing kind of a harm reduction housing or housing first approach then and getting some pushback. So I started at DESC shortly before we really in earnest started development of the 1811 Eastlake building, which is a relatively well-known Housing First project here in Seattle and also across the country, because we were pretty deliberate in how we designed that building to prioritize people who had the longest histories of homelessness, who were living with alcohol addiction issues, and who were also the highest utilizers of healthcare and other public services in the community. And so that got a lot of attention. And the fact that we intended to operate on a voluntary service, you know, sobriety not required basis was it was novel to folks. It wasn't the first harm reduction housing approach that DESC had taken. We had a strong experience doing that. Probably before that, we're well known for our Lion Building project for people living with HIV who also were substance users. And we were in partnership with AIDS Housing of Washington, and we were pretty deliberate then. That was before my time at DESC. And so I remember those conversations, including with County Executive Ron Sims, who was pretty nervous about the 1811 Eastlake model, and Mayor Greg Nichols at the time, and sharing with them the evidence of, you know, what high healthcare, law enforcement, emergency department utilization meant in terms of dollars and cents, and the fact that supportive housing could be operated on a housing first approach could really not only improve quality of life, which of course, because of DESC's mission and the people who work there, we were very focused on, but it also could provide significant community savings. And we got those folks, Mayor Nichols and Executive Sims, on board, and other community leaders, and over the years, certainly pushed for and saw success in Housing First being a preferred model because of a growing amount of evidence for it. Now, I think as we've seen homelessness really increase significantly due to high housing costs and lack of access to basic services, including behavioral health services, there is a community backlash here in the Seattle area, but also nationally, saying, well, you did Housing First. There's still homeless people. There's more homeless people than ever before, so it must not work. When we know, of course, for the people who do move into Housing First, supportive housing, that it does work for the people who are able to get into it, but there's not enough. So we're in a new, I feel like I'm back to where we were in 2002, where we're just doing basic education and to explain what are the tenets of Housing First and why it is successful. And even more so now, I feel like we're really talking a lot about how more coercive models just don't work for people, that people tend to find their way to places where they feel both safe and can retain their own sense of self-determination. And if they don't get that they will sometimes return to the streets. Mm-hmm. What we have always said at DESC is people don't reject housing, they reject programs. And in social services, we like to create a lot of programs that put a lot of requirements on people. And then sometimes we will say things like people are, quote, resistant to services, when in fact what people want is they want to get their needs met, but they want to retain their dignity and self-determination, mm-hmm. which, I mean, we all want that. So it's just fascinating to me that we have to keep coming back to that lesson.
To that same, right. And Ricky's Law, which is quite fascinating. I didn't even know about it until recently because I would never use it myself as a healthcare provider.
Yeah.
But, but yes, hearing the rhetoric.
That's a good example.
Locally and nationally about.
There's a lot of, and I discovered as a legislator too, because now I hear from a broader group of people, you know, I hear a lot of requests for expanding our Involuntary Treatment Act, that if we could just coerce people a little bit more, then it would work better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just go back to my, the evidence that there's no evidence that coercion works, and actually there is a place for involuntary commitments, but we should keep it as narrow as possible.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, improve our behavioral health system because of how much people fall through the cracks of that, even if they can get access to it.
So. Yeah, you know, it's on my mind today because I did a visit to Harborview this week. All of the hospitals, but Harborview probably most acutely, is concerned about patients who they have called difficult-to-discharge patients. These are patients who don't need acute care hospitalization, but they need continual care, probably in a long-term care setting like a skilled nursing facility or assisted living, but could be home care. But so they can't just leave the hospital without any care plan. But the hospital dischargers are struggling to find placements for folks. And so they describe the problem that we have all these people who don't need our hospital care, but they're here because we don't have a better place that can more appropriately serve them, which means that our kind of inpatient folks are being squeezed and displaced because we have too many patients who don't need to be here. And then the front door, you know, usually through the emergency department, is getting backed up. And they gave an example. It's a stressful week this week in Seattle because we're going through an extended heat wave. And so all the hospitals are sort of on alert about heat-related emergencies. And the emergency room medical director said, you know, just this afternoon we had no available ambulances to go on call in Seattle because they were all at emergency departments waiting to transition their patients to the ED. But they struggled to do that because the hospitals are all backed up,
right? Wow.
And so what I thought immediately was like, oh, the medical system is going through a crisis that the behavioral health system has been in for years. Because that's how I would really describe it. We don't have enough places for people to go that fit their needs, be it supportive housing, maybe long-term residential, behavioral health care.
Medical respite.
And so we have all of these people who are homeless living with very severe behavioral health conditions, and then they are trying to get in the front door, usually through the crisis system, and the crisis system is totally overloaded and can't respond. And we just haven't built in all of those pieces the way Harborview described it, our inpatient, our path out of the hospital to discharge, and our emergency department. In fact, in the Seattle region, for people who don't have the most severe behavioral health emergency, who really need to go to a hospital emergency department, usually to get admitted in for inpatient psychiatric care, we don't really have options, right? So we know we can go to urgent care for physical health care. You know, you cut your finger real bad, or you fall on your knee and you're like, oh, I probably should have a doctor look at this, but it's not so bad that I need to go to the emergency room. There are these other levels of care we can get on the physical health care side. But for people, when we fall into behavioral health crisis, there's very limited options. And so we have a lot to do. I have worked on community behavioral health policy and investments alongside my work on housing the entire time I've been in the legislature, and it's a long endeavor. I knew that going into it, but it seems like every year we go back to the legislature, we discover how a gap in the system is really profoundly harming people. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a dam that is like just spurting water everywhere. And I feel like every session we're going back and trying to plug
little holes.
I mean, we've made some big strides, you know, thanks in part to the pandemic. And as behavioral health concerns have become more universal, as more families have seen the impacts of the stress of the pandemic, there has been more of a focus on behavioral health, but we certainly didn't have a system that is or will be anytime soon ready to respond to the growing needs we see in the community. And of course, people with the most acute needs are the ones who are impacted the most.
And then the criminal justice system as part of all that and complicating it.
Indeed, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we have a lot to unwind and
fix.
So
you have more work to do.
A lot more, yeah. And I just hear we have more people who are arrested and then committed on what they, you know, on forensic holds, as they call it, because we, as a community, watch people's crisis just grow and grow until it gets to the point where they or other people are at risk. We could catch these things much sooner. And of course, if we provided ongoing access to care and stable housing.
And coordinated care.
Yeah, and coordinating that care, that we wouldn't see as much crisis. But now in the policy realm, there's a lot of focus on crisis response. Mm-hmm. What are we doing about crisis response? I'm like, we created the crisis.
Yeah. Right. Right. And then, as you were saying and illustrating with what Harborview is dealing with right now, right, you have the emergency room, you have the crisis, but then what do you do with the entire kind of pipeline of that and
exactly. The
continuity of care, continuum of care? Wow. So can you tell me a little about the Seattle housing levy and the current one and your work on that and what your hopes? I guess it's coming up for renewal or for something next year. Is that correct?
Yep. So I've worked on the housing levy and I think the last three campaigns of the housing levy. And I think there's a lot of focus. The levy is the current one is a 7-year levy. It's up for renewal next year. And so what typically happens is the mayor and the Office of Housing and the city government sort of come up with a plan of how big the levy will be and what it will fund over the next 7 years and transmit that to council. Council fine-tunes it, and then mayor signs it, and it goes to the voters. You know, I think there's a lot of conversation about what is the right size for the levy. I think currently, or the one we passed last time, was like 14 cents per $1,000 of property value. It's a property tax levy. And the question is, well, what if you took it to 25 cents or 15 or, you know, whatever? How much money would that return? There's a lot of the total kind of projected revenue over the 7 years for the current levy is about $290 million. So there's some conversation about, do we need to set a target of $1 billion? And, you know, what's the tax impact of that? And then how would we distribute the funds? And I think the voters are continue to be very interested in addressing homelessness. But there is also, of course, growing concern about general access to affordable housing within the city of Seattle. Mm-hmm. That's been the case for the last three levies I've been involved in. But it feels even, you know, more true now that housing is more and more out of reach for even the middle class. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's astounding to me that in my neighborhood, the average home is valued at over $1 million. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the norm probably, or starting to be the norm in many areas of the city.
Right. And I just saw the Low Income Housing Institute there, whatever their annual one is of affordability across the country. And I looked at Seattle's, and it's just gotten worse.
I looked at, I think the most recent report said in King County or the Seattle area, to afford the average apartment, you need to earn about $40 an hour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one I saw today was something $33 an hour, but that was like working 86 hours a week. So, yeah, that's like not – well, I know people do that, but it's not sustainable.
No. Yeah, so I think we're still in the kind of debating conversation phase of the housing levy. The Seattle voters have voted to pass few housing levies with pretty significant support.
Mm-hmm.
There has always been a question. So in the 2009 levy, which was two levies ago, we had the Great Recession had just hit, and there was a lot of trepidation mm-hmm. about tax sensitivity and would people vote for this still? And that passed overwhelmingly. And again, in 2016, the levy passed with like over 70% of the vote. And so I think there'll be all the usual planning and polling to get a sense of where the voters' appetite is in terms of mm-hmm. tax, the tax amount, as well as the kinds of investments voters would like to see.
Right, and especially if they come up on a recession. For people as well. Yes. So talk with me about, you've mentioned some of this, the pushback for more conservative, for the most part, more conservative sector of even our community, but the whole thing with Compassion Seattle
mm-hmm.
and the increasing moves, not just Seattle and King County, but across the state mm-hmm. in terms of criminalizing homelessness and poverty.
Yeah. I mean, people sometimes call it compassion fatigue, that mm-hmm. that residents generally are well-intended and want to help, but they're just tired of there not being faster solutions. And so many of my colleagues, politicians, are very drawn towards quick solutions. And people ask me, my colleagues in the legislature ask me, but Nicole, what can we do right away?
What can we do to fix it?
Yeah, right now, what you're talking about, building more housing, takes a really long time. Well, so that is true. There are things we can do, and we've learned some things through the pandemic. Like, we can take advantage of market opportunities that might be out there to acquire housing more rapidly. We can convert hotels into short-term places where people can live and get support instead of congregate shelters. So there are things we've learned about what we can do more quickly. But often it sort of morphs into this conversation that, well, people are just going to be complacent and stay and want to stay along the side of the road in a green space.
Service resistant.
Yeah, unless you tell them to move along and tell them they have to take the options that are available. And it gets back to that same thing, is that we find you can move people who are unsheltered off of a place. But unless you give them a solution that is better in all or most ways than they perceive the staying outdoors is, then they're going to return outdoors. They may not return to the same location. They may return to someplace nearby. And we've seen some news reports about that people were given offers of shelter. They either didn't even go in for the first day, never showed up, or they went and then they returned to living unsheltered. And so, it's that, you know, they say like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. And it does feel a little bit like that, that we should learn that if you give that we need to listen to people. I mean, I think that's another thing I really learned from Bill Hobson and my work at DESC, which is that the work has to be guided by the people who you are serving. Mm-hmm. We often say, like, clients vote with their feet, right? If they are showing up, it means you're doing something right. And if they're not, if they don't stick around, it means something's not working for them. And we saw that for many years. I mean, we operated, you know, one of the largest congregate shelters in downtown Seattle for over 40 years. And most people only stayed short amount of time, and a very small subset stayed for a very long amount of time. And I think people were voting with their feet that, you know, this isn't necessarily better than my alternate options, which often were pretty undesirable alternatives, usually sleeping outside. And we were aware of that, but tried to deal with this tension of well, how can we assist the greatest number of people while providing a service that's worthwhile to everyone? And I think through the pandemic, we learned that we were contributing to harm in ways that we probably never fully appreciated.
Like what?
You know, just that congregate settings can be really traumatizing for folks, and that when we have a situation like we have now where it takes a long time to get into a stable housing situation, that the temporary stopgap measure that we create, the design of that really matters. And that if you just sort of warehouse people knowing that it could take weeks or months or sometimes years for people to actually get that golden ticket to housing, then that experience in that temporary assistance and that temporary shelter could be traumatizing,
right,
for people. And I think we saw it physically in people's the way they carried themselves, the way they looked when they moved into hotel based shelter, just that
they had their own place, they could lock the door, they had a bathroom.
I mean, we would talk about it quite a lot at the Morrison, the DESC main shelter, just when we would train staff and about sort of compassionate, trauma-informed care for people, it was like, imagine the only place you had to use the bathroom was a bathroom that, you know, always had 6 or 8 stalls and showers that were lined up next to each other rather than your own space. We need to be mindful of the experiences clients are going through as we're engaging with them, why they are on edge. But to just see the contrast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were a little embarrassed that we hadn't realized it sooner. But I think we acknowledged that, and I think said pretty early in the pandemic,
you're not going back there.
Never. We're never going back. We just can't. Now that we see, and I think it's true, like in supportive housing, when we first, before my time, but when DESE first started doing supportive housing, they would screen people out. They would try to guess who would be successful mm-hmm. in housing based on, you know, their characteristics while they were living homeless. And I think over time discovered you really can't predict who's going to succeed and who's going to fail. And it's almost like the employees would try to guess, like, oh, Tommy is just, he'll never last in that apartment. And he maybe does great. And the person who was really quiet and didn't really cause any ripples in the shelter struggled to maintain mm-hmm. housing for whatever reason. So at a certain point, we said, why are we even trying to screen?
Right. Yeah, the whole housing readiness yeah. and transitional housing that also doesn't work well for homeless families and others, not just the single adults.
Yeah,
that
this
you all deal with.
Idea that we can fix you, right? Mm-hmm. We can fix you and then you will be fixed and be able to just be a fully independent
right.
individual. We're not taking into account all of the oppressions that society puts on people, and those don't go away after mm-hmm. 24 months. It's kind of like inpatient substance use
yes,
treatment.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, and similar kind of the panopticon. I mean, you're under surveillance 24/7
right.
by, you know, people that have more power than you.
Right.
That doesn't make any of us feel good.
Exactly. So I feel like we're... The longer I do this work, the more I feel like it's true, history repeats itself, and we're always learning the same lessons, which for me is a helpful experience, in part because I do feel like, oh, we've been here before, you know, a different iteration, you know, when the society at large wasn't ready to hear what works best. And so that's a challenge for those of us who do this work. And I had an interesting conversation recently about there's a bit of a debate, which to me just doesn't seem very fruitful, around is homelessness a housing problem mm-hmm. or is it a mental health or drug problem? And that seems to be the dynamic in Seattle. There's sort of the camp of people who believe it's a housing problem and another camp that believes, no, this is a drug problem, that we've had a worsening drug problem in Seattle and we've seen a concurrent worsening in homelessness, so they must be interconnected. And I think it's true we have a housing problem and it's true we have a drug problem now. And for many people who need housing, they also need a lot of support to address the impacts of their substance use. But I think people are so frustrated, they've sort of gone back to these moralistic attitudes that seem more pervasive, 15, 20 years ago of
mm-hmm.
we should just force people to stop using drugs.
Right. Yeah. And then the whole kind of debate between, you know, people usually in the you know, homelessness is just a housing problem of using houseless versus homeless.
And yeah, yeah.
It is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So
I think more people can relate to the fact that housing can definitely slip out of reach for people. I've heard a lot, you know, I've worked a lot in the legislature on renter protection policy. My motivation around that is that I know to address homelessness, we need to get upstream. And as I started reading more and more research about the fact that we saw increases nationally in evictions over the last, you know, quarter century, and more people who were evicted became immediately homeless and stayed homeless for some period, I really started thinking about, well, how can we prevent people from being evicted? So I've worked on, you know, ending no-cause evictions, adding a right to legal representation for low-income tenants when they're going through eviction court. And we've tried to work on stabilizing rents. Some states, including Oregon and California, implemented caps on how much rent can be increased year over year. We have struggled to get support, enough support in the legislature for those kinds of policies, even struggled to get a bill that we worked hard on this year to allow for 6 months of notice if you have a significant rent increase. So, you know, in the past few months, I've heard from more and more people, both here in Seattle, but also in other cities around the state, about these enormous rent increases that have occurred. This is a national challenge that we're hearing about. But 30, 40, 100% rent increases. And so I think more and more people can relate to that.
Or have a relative or some friend.
Where people have said, well, I have to move, you know, 10 or 20 miles further out from my job in order to afford a place. But they could see that at a certain point, maybe they can afford nothing. And that connection between housing costs and homelessness. But the debate continues about that. So my sense is we have to work on, like, it's not very fruitful to engage in the debate, but instead work on housing solutions and work on substance use and mental health support solutions.
Right. And then racial justice kinds of things within housing and homelessness, too.
Yeah. So. I mean, that is very like I always say that particularly in my political life, a lot of Democrats are willing to stand up for civil rights until we really get to the heart of it, which for me is economic justice, right? That economic injustice, the lack of access to opportunity, to stable housing, to, you know, healthcare, given our profit-driven healthcare delivery system. When we start talking about bringing more equity to those systems, more justice to who gets housing and who doesn't, Then I rub up against Democrats saying, well, I'm as worried about the property owner's interests as I am about the people who are living homeless, which I just sort of scratch my head and I think we're worried about protecting someone's investment as much as we are about
it's their constituents.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a continual challenge in doing this work is, you know, how do we shift the narrative a bit? And we've been able to do, we've gotten some success, but, you know, some days it does feel like things are pretty challenging right now.
Yes. So let me see. I am taking your time. So are there any, if this is great, are there any questions or things that you wanted to ask yourself, answer yourself that you wanted to include?
You know, every year I have been in the legislature, we've had more success than the year before in terms of investments and policies for that address homelessness and provide for more access to housing. And I often wonder, you know, are we getting better at this and it'll continue to be incrementally better? Or are we in some kind of period of good times and we're going to get slapped back when the bad times return? And, you know, I often try to think about, you know, those the years before the Great Recession, for example, when the economy was doing relatively well and government was making investments. We actually saw pretty significant decreases in homelessness. We saw increases in homelessness in this region and around the country between about the late 70s and the early 2000s. There were steady increases in homelessness. And then at least here and in some other parts of the country, we started to see decreases in homelessness. And we were thinking, oh, we're getting it right. This is good. When we invest in the right strategies at the right levels, we're seeing good results. And then the recession hit, and it really kind of hit the public sector a few years after 2008, mm-hmm. when the stock market crashed and the banks started closing. And then we started to see a dramatic increase in homelessness, right, starting about 2012, 2013, and steadily got somewhat accelerated during the pandemic. And really in the last 2 years especially, we've seen some pretty significant investments. And, you know, just this week I read a headline that with federal investment, these emergency housing vouchers the federal government put out as part of a pandemic response, 800 folks got homes here in the Seattle area. And typically it's taken us a really long time to put together enough resource to find housing for 800 people. And so I just wonder, you know, can we keep this pace? Can we say we've set a new floor in terms of the amount of investment, the pace of policy change we need to make? And can we keep at that? Or are we going to make the same mistakes, mm-hmm. I guess, that we made during the recession? We had a lot of conversation as legislators when the pandemic first hit and so many people lost their jobs, mm-hmm. and the state tax collections went down dramatically. And a lot of the conversation was we have to be mindful not to make the same mistakes we made in the last recession. But I feel like people are worn down by the pandemic. And as mm-hmm. we enter into this now or maybe continued economically uncertain time where there's a lot of conversation recently about, are we going to get hit with recession? How big is the recession going to be? I just wonder and hope that we continue to have the same conversation of not making the same mistakes that tightening of the belt has a disproportionate harm to vulnerable communities, mm-hmm. and does it not help us to recover economically as quickly as investing in the communities that need the most support during challenging times. So that's what I'm sort of, that's what's mostly on my mind as I listen to the recent news reports and think about what's ahead for the state. And as I come back to that work, I just feel so fortunate to be able to continue to work at DESC and serve in the legislature. I do feel like it gives me this edge over other folks because I feel like I have a feedback loop that's a little bit faster mm-hmm. about what we're doing in terms of state or local policy impacts
the most vulnerable.
Yeah, the communities who you know, we aim to assist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good combination if you can keep up the energy.
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, I would love to ask you also about domestic violence and reproductive rights, but that could be a whole other chapter, right?
Yeah, that's a different
oral history. One.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely challenging times right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the domestic violence that you know definitely was complicated and increased during the pandemic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't go there. But
okay.
Thank you for your work in that. That's close to my heart. So thank you very much for taking time. And again, thanks for all you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for doing this project. It's one that I know we'll appreciate even more, you know, years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I know from your work already that you've done some like looking back in time
mm-hmm.
and sort of sharing the trajectory of history. And it's just so important for us to do because you can mm-hmm. see those threads from
right.
our very early history
yes.
as a community here.
Yeah. And as a country.
Yeah.
Bootstraps, individual stuff.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. I was talking to someone from British Columbia yesterday, and we were talking about housing first. And, you know, I was saying, like, all these concepts that just seem totally normal to people from British mm-hmm. Columbia, that you sort of start mm-hmm. with a dignified approach where people have self-determination. And, you know, we had to really educate people here in the U.S., about why that works.
And still educate.
Yeah,
that's...
And he was like, yeah.
Yeah, the whole idea of social exclusion, which is huge in the UK and in Europe. And it's just, I mean, it's a different culture that we don't really have here, so...
Yeah.
But thanks for taking time. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.